Welcome to The Auction Brief.
There's a joy to this game, is there not?
Taking you on a journey through fantasy football, the law, and life.
This is all yours to take. Depends on how much you want.
And now, your legal analyst and auction draft expert, here to help you dominate your fantasy drafts, your host, Drew Davenport.
Clear eyes, full hearts.
Can't lose. Let's go play some football. Let's go!
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Auction Brief. As the lady said, I'm your host, Drew Davenport, and thank you so much for joining me for a special in-season edition of the Auction Brief. As you all know, the show itself is really tailored toward draft prep and auction drafting in general. So I told you that I wasn't going to be back during the season with every week episodes. That's just not what the intent of the show was, but that I did want to drop a few shows for everybody as the season goes on, telling you a little bit about my thoughts about what's going on during the season. I'm going to save some of my critiquing of my auction drafting for the off season, drop a few shows like that in the boring months of March and April when maybe you're starving for some content. We can talk about what I did right and wrong in my auction drafts, but right now it's about winning now. We are, believe it or not, over a third of the way through the fantasy football regular season. That is crazy. I haven't recorded a show since the end of August, and I got a lot of things to say. It's all building up inside behind a dam, ready to break loose. I feel like Costanza's father. I got a lot of problems with you people. I'm just kidding. I don't have a lot of problems. I got a lot of things to say, though. I got a lot to get off my chest because we are over a third of the way through the regular season. And if you're still paying attention to ADP or where you drafted somebody or guys on your team that aren't performing, even though you drafted them high, then you're doing it wrong. We are way too far into the season for you to still be thinking about ADP or where you drafted somebody or whether you should play them because they weren't drafted very highly. That's over. Time to move on. This is a new reality, and there are a lot of things that are happening that we couldn't predict, and you need to adjust. The important thing is remembering that we are in a very unique situation in this game that we play. And that unique situation boils down to one thing. We are wrong a lot. And when I say we, I mean you, I mean me, I mean football guys, I mean Fighting Chance Fantasy. Anybody that you're looking to for information, we're going to be wrong a lot. The thing is, can you be wrong less than other people? And also, what is your process for grinding out the future of your team and the game that we play? And when I say the process, I know that that tends to be one of those buzzwords that people love to use, but I really believe it's an important concept. And that's really where I want to start this episode, about process. Because process matters a lot. I got a message this week, and I'm going to leave the name anonymous, but I got a message this week talking about how one of the followers, that he's a really staunch supporter of mine. He messages me for advice, and I enjoy talking to him, and I enjoy his perspective. He was really feeling down this week because he just can't win a fantasy football game. And I looked at his squad, and it's not a bad team. It's a good team. The thing is, sometimes that's going to happen. You have to understand that the process is more important than the results. Of course we want to see results. Of course we want to win. The process is there because we're trying to win. But the point here is that the process matters. And eventually, if you keep sticking to the grind, if you keep grinding it out every week, you follow the process, you get involved in the things that you should be involved in, studying the right things, listening to the right people, you will win football games. But that's where I want to start because it's kind of a difficult story to tell. I think that I'm self-deprecating sometimes to a fault. I'm not here talking to you about fantasy football because I suck at it. In fact, let me just preface this situation by saying I'm actually one hell of a redraft player. Okay, there's a lot of luck that goes into winning. I get all that, but I can play the hell out of a redraft league. Okay, so I may not be this dynasty expert or whatever, but you want to win a redraft league, you come to me. Okay. I know how to play redraft fantasy football. And here's the thing. This is the difficult part to say. In my friend group, in the group of guys that I play poker with, and the folks that I play fantasy football with, I have a reputation. My reputation is as that of a total badass. Just kidding. No, my reputation is that I'm the most tortured guy in the league. I'm the most tortured guy at the at the poker table. When it comes to luck, the luck factor, I might be the most tortured guy you're going to meet when it comes to games of chance. Okay? That's just how it's been. It's been that way for a long time. And I think that if you ask anybody in my peer group, they would tell you the same thing. Hey, in your league, who's the most tortured guy? Drew. Like, I don't think it's even an option to pick anybody else. They pick me. And I think that there's two reasons for that. I think number one, I have had a lot of bad luck. But number two, I think that I whine about it more than most. So they begin to believe that I am actually more tortured than others, and when maybe I'm not. And I think, of course, perception is reality in a lot of phases of life. You know, I will say this. I have a bit of a tortured mindset because of the things that have happened to me in fantasy football and poker. It just feels like you're not going to win sometimes. And that's part of the message that I got from one of my supporters this week, that he just feels like he can't win. And I understand that. And sometimes that's true. You're not going to win. But sometimes, and this is really important for me to keep telling myself on a day-to-day basis, sometimes you're just seeing the negative in the situation when there's plenty of positive there. And I really do believe, and this is might come as a surprise to some of the people who know me, but has anybody ever heard of the book The Secret? Now, in general, I don't believe in a lot of this stuff, and I think the book The Secret, you know, it takes things a little bit far. But the point of the book The Secret was, what you put out into the universe will be reflected back to you. Now, I'm a very well-educated person. I have a degree from Indiana University with a major in philosophy and a minor in religious studies. I have a Juris Doctor from The Ohio State University. I feel like I'm a really educated person. But if I were to sit here and say that I have the universe on lockdown, I figured out the universe, or I read this book from some guy who has it figured out, yeah, I'd be lying to you. That's silly. We all know that's silly. And I think for us to sit here and say that we know the universe and we get everything about what's happening to us or how things occur, then we'd be silly to say that. It's the height of hubris to say that we have the universe figured out. So I really do believe in the fact that what you put out there is reflected back to you. And I think it's very possible that my negativity can be reflected back to me in poor results and poor luck over my lifetime. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. I do believe in it because I believe that it's silly for us to sit here and think that we know it all and that we've got it all figured out. I mean, 100 years ago, we didn't know what the heck an electron was. So there are things that we don't know that we have not figured out yet. And it'd be the height of hubris to think that we have figured it all out. So what's my point? Well, I do believe that you need to put positivity out there. But I also believe when it comes to fantasy football, that we need to continue to grind and respect the process of putting ourselves in a position to win. Because this game that we play, and the fact that we have this issue with the fact that we're going to be wrong a lot, it doesn't necessarily mean that the universe is punishing you and that you should go into a shell and be negative and feel badly about it. What it means is that you're simply in the trough of variance. We play this game on a weekly basis, despite the fact that next summer somebody's going to tell you, hey, X player actually ended up as PPR wide receiver 27, and he's being drafted as wide receiver 45. I can guarantee you I'm going to send 47 of those tweets. But the point is, we have to keep in mind that despite the fact that we're looking at a 17-game or previously 16-game sample size, A, That's still considered to be, in my mind, pretty short run. And I'll talk about that in a second, what it means to be short run versus long run. But that's pretty short run in and of itself, one season of games. But on top of that, think about how we live and die with every single game that we play each week. When the long run, the long-term results, the statistical variance is much, much longer than in one Sunday or five Sundays or 17 Sundays. I liken it to, of course, poker. When I first started out and I was reading poker books and they were talking about the fact that you'd rather have a pair of deuces than ace-king, I couldn't believe it. And the reason was they had run 100,000 computer simulations on which hand is going to be more profitable in the long run should you put the money in preflop and C5 cards. I didn't understand that at the time. Of course, we're not talking about playing the hand on the flop with a pair of deuces. That's difficult. That's a whole different conversation. But the point is, if you shove the money in preflop and just run five cards out, you're going to win more often with deuces than ace king. But it takes 100,000 simulations to see that you're a 52-48% favorite. Well, why is that? Because long run is way longer than we think it is. Drum that into your head. Don't ever forget that. Long run is way longer than we think it is. So when we're heading into week six in the NFL, we're dealing with five games. Yes, you have to draw some conclusions from the data points that we have, but that's not long run. There's going to be so many wild things that happen. Think about yourself eating some turkey on Thanksgiving and watching the Lions and trying to figure out what the heck has happened the last 5 weeks. It's going to be wildly different in week 10 or 11 than it is right now heading into week six. So even that short period of time is changing things. So our opinions are going to change every week, every 5 weeks, every month, every year. The point is, the short run, we are a captive of the moment. We're a captive of that short run. And don't lose sight of the fact that the long run is way longer than we think. So our process matters. All you can do is put yourself in a position to win. And like I said, I might be considered in my peer group to be one of the most tortured fantasy football and poker players that you know. I'm in a league, and let me tell a little story about this, okay? Because I think this is a great illustration of what I'm trying to say. I'm in a league that, this is my own league. I came up with this league a few years ago, and it's essentially a best ball league with in-season management. We have big rosters. It's a 10-teamer, but we have big 22-man rosters with two IR spots. And it's a 7-keeper league, so we're keeping about a third of our roster. So not full dynasty, but we are keeping a healthy amount of people. And it's an auction, so we do carry over player salaries from year to year. This is a super flex as well. That was one of the things that I wanted to do. Was I came up with this about 10 years ago, and that's largely before super flex was becoming popular, but I realized it was sort of the future. I was hearing a lot about it, so I wanted to do a super flex. Anyway, my quarterbacks are ridiculous. I have Patrick Mahomes, Josh Allen, and Dak Prescott this year, but I also have Deshaun Watson. Yeah, my quarterbacks are ridiculous. I don't know how they let me do that. But anyway, a couple years ago, I won back-to-back titles, and that was one I could check off the bucket list. And I don't know if any of you have a fantasy bucket list, but I certainly do. Winning back-to-back titles is on the fantasy bucket list. And of course, after you win two, what's next on the list? You want to win three, right? The year I went into trying to win three was the year that Cam Newton hurt his foot in the preseason and Ben Roethlisberger underwent elbow surgery after week two, got hurt first half of week two against Seattle. Those were two of my three quarterbacks. In fact, I might have had four quarterbacks, but bottom line is I had three of my four quarterbacks get hurt before, you know, week three or four. I had lost most of my quarterbacks, never contended. And I always said that I had a great chance to three-peat until I lost most of my quarterbacks in a super flex. Again, you know, piling on the tortured idea, which is kind of silly because I had won two previous titles. So how tortured could I be? Again, it's all about your perspective and what you put out in the universe. But I sort of expected to get dealt with on that third year, trying to win it a third time. But who cares? Anyway, the point is, that you can go through the process as well as you possibly can, but you need some help from the universe and from the short-term variance. Because no matter what happens with the long-term variance, you need help in the short term. And here's a perfect example of this. Last year, my big weak spot was the tight end spot. I was trying to stream that all year, and I was carrying three guys. And like I said, it's best ball with in-season management. So I was trying to carry three crap tight ends and hope that one of them hit every week to get into my lineup and score me 15 points. So I got to the playoffs, and I had a pretty sizable advantage. It's a unique scoring system. I won't bore you with that. But I had a pretty sizable advantage. But I kept telling myself every point's going to matter in the final 3 weeks of the season, because it's a cumulative three-week playoff where you try to score the most points during the 3 weeks of the playoffs. And so I said, I really need to buckle down and check out who I'm going to be playing at tight end, because my tight ends were largely crap to that point. Just had not done a lot, but I've been getting by on the strength of my wide receivers and my quarterbacks, and my wide receivers were dropping like flies. I lost guys like DJ Moore was hurt, Will Fuller was suspended, Terry McLaurin was hurt. I had these guys that were carrying me all year suddenly gone, and I thought, I need some tight end help. So what did I do? I went to the grind. I decided I'm going to map out what I'm going to do in the 3 weeks of the playoffs to get some tight end points to make sure that I win this title. So week 14, I take a look. The Chicago Bears are one of the worst teams at defending the tight ends last year. So who do I find? I find Jordan Akins on the wire. Fantastic. I'm going to put Jordan Akins on my team. Hopefully he's going to catch a touchdown against the Bears, because that's just what they do. The bonus was that I had Deshaun Watson. So I thought, all right, I can get a Watson to Akins, double touchdown. Hopefully that's going to work out against the Bears because they're so soft against the tight end spot. And what happened right in the, I believe in the first half of the game, Watson rolls out. Jordan Akins is wide open in the back corner of the end zone. He puts it on the numbers. And I don't know, I think Akins might have said that he lost the ball in the sun, but it doesn't matter. Bounces off his chest, drops a wide open touchdown. There was nobody within 5 yards of him. He just flat out dropped the touchdown. I'm like, all right, that's pretty funny. Who cares? Let's move on to week 15. I look and I see that, oh, the Vikings have the Bears. The same defense I targeted last week. Now Irv Smith is still on the wire because, of course, Rudolph was the guy to have last year. But Irv Smith is still on the wire, and he's got the Bears this week. Fantastic. Sign me up. I drop Akins, pick up Smith, and wouldn't you know it, Irv Smith dropped a touchdown. I can still see it in my head. He's in the front right corner of the end zone. Cousins puts it on him. It's a hard throw, and but the catch wasn't difficult. It hit him right in the gut, bounced off his hands. He dropped it. Yep, 2 weeks in a row, I picked up the correct tight end off of the wire who had an easy touchdown catch, and 2 weeks in a row, dropped it. Okay, we're heading into week 16. We still got a lead, but I still want to cement this title. I look and see who do I have or who's going to be available. And I realized that I want to just keep a roster spot open. I want to see if the two tight ends I got on my roster are going to do anything. One of them was Dallas Goedert. And I thought, well, I'm going to see if they do anything. I leave a roster spot open. And I realized that in Sunday night and Monday night games, there are a couple tight ends that I could roll with that I'm fine with if I need some tight end points. So it comes down to, yep, my team's doing fine, except the tight end spot once again. And I sign up for Dawson Knox on Monday Night Football. It might have been Sunday night. Regardless, in the late game, I put Knox on my team. He's got the Patriots. They haven't been great at defending the tight end, and I know that Knox has a chance to catch a touchdown, and of course, the game sets up perfectly. I remember Knox streaking through the back of the end zone. It's the back left corner of the end zone. Josh Allen puts it right on his chest, and he's got a touchdown pass easily. And it bounces off his chest and falls to the turf. Yes, folks, when I talk about being tortured, I don't do so lightly. I don't know that I've ever heard a story like this. And it is 100% true. You can poll the guys in my league. My buddy Mike, He knows all about it because I will never stop talking about it. I picked up a guy weeks 14, 15, and 16. And each week, that guy dropped a touchdown pass. And these aren't, I'm not talking about a 40-yard touchdown where he had to make a tough catch. I'm talking about a touchdown where the quarterback put it in his gut or on his numbers, and he flat dropped it. Now, when I talk about being tortured, that's being tortured, folks. And I'm not sitting here to tell you this story because I want you to feel bad for me. What I want you to understand is that the process matters. My process was sound. Picking up Akins and Irv Smith against the Bears was sound. Leaving an open roster spot to pick up a tight end later if I needed it was sound. I picked up Knox, who had a chance to score. He dropped the ball. Point is, the process was sound. Yeah, I'm tortured. Yeah, it didn't work out. But if you continue to put yourself in that situation, you're going to win a lot of fantasy football games. So it's week 5. We're heading into week 6. Don't give up on the process that's allowed you to have a good roster or put you in a position to win just because you haven't actually won. And I'm going to give you a few tips about how to do that and how to go about that. But the point is, you are here listening to me because part of your process is to become informed, to become smarter, to become better at the game that we're playing. So your process is already pretty good. You don't need to go reinventing the wheel and changing everything about what you're doing just because you're not winning fantasy football games. Sometimes the short run is just the short run, and the variance is just going to get you. Long run is longer than we think, and you have to understand when you're playing this game, that's how it goes. If you're putting the work in, you're putting the time in, you're making good decisions, you will win fantasy football games in the long run. All right, well, that's probably enough about process and short-term and long-term and blah, blah, blah. But there's a reason I tell you about the fact that, you know, poker simulators, they run hands over 100,000 hands. And I sat next to a guy at the table the other day who made the comment, and I hear this comment all the time at poker tables. Well, aces aren't that great of a hand. I lost this the other day, or I lost that the other day. No, stop, right there. Aces are the most profitable hand in poker. You think you lose a lot with aces because you remember all the beats. You don't remember all the times that you raised preflop, two people called, and the flop was queen 7-3, and you bet and they folded. You don't remember all those times. I had poker tracking software back in the day when I used to play online. It's kind of funny because I got it right before I got online poker yanked from me. But I had the software long enough to realize that my most profitable hands were ace-ace and ace-king suited. And, you know, kings and queens, and they were all up there at the top. So the hands that are supposed to be profitable are, don't remember the beats, remember the times that you're profitable with them. And anyway, the point is, I do have, believe it or not, a couple poker stories. It's been 6 weeks. Of course, I've been playing some poker, and we need to talk about those couple of those hands, right? And then I'm going to hit a couple other quick hitter type game theory ideas about fantasy football. And like I said, I've had some people saying they just don't get enough. Hey, how do you play fantasy football advice versus advice on players? So I'm going to hit, I got 3 additional points about winning fantasy football in general right now, heading into week 6. And then, of course, it wouldn't be Drew's Clues if we didn't go through some situations about players, about backfields, wide receiver core, injuries, stuff like that. So we'll hit some of those, and then we'll get you out of here. I know I've been talking already. It's been 25 minutes already, but let's talk a couple poker stories before we get into the meat of the rest of the show. So the other day, I'm playing a tournament, and I haven't been able to find my normal tournament, which is a tournament at the Lawrenceburg Casino, Lawrenceburg, Indiana. Had a great tournament on Saturday nights. It started at 9:15, and it was perfect for its profitability because it didn't have antes, which, believe it or not, eat away at your stack more than you think. So there's no antes in the tournament. It was 15-minute levels. It used to be 20, but they chopped it down to 15. Whatever. It's still enough that when you're playing in a casino, you're getting a lot of hands in, and you get a lot of the Saturday night bro factor, you know, guys who go to the casino and they're get kind of drunk and they're tired of playing slots, or they're tired of throwing dice or whatever. And they go, hey, there's a poker tournament, and let's go check it out. So you get enough of the bro factor that it's a very profitable tournament, but it's not there anymore. So I'm forced to go to a different casino and play a very tough tournament. There aren't many tournaments that you find in a casino that are as tough as this one. And I'm not saying it's like All-Stars or whatever, but there is clearly a lot of guys who sit down and play this tournament and grind it out. It's at 10:15 in the morning. There is actually a large percentage of guys who are over the age of 60. And they do this every day, and you can tell. And then the other guys who are not that age are guys that you can see are playing a good amount of poker every day. So it's a good tournament. It's some good competition. So the reason I'm saying that is it sets the stage for the two stories I want to tell, because I'm not playing against your normal yokels. And I will say that I've had some comments from some people about, I am self-deprecating about this stuff almost to a fault. I understand I never tell stories about me winning, but I want to tell two stories about me winning today. And these aren't necessarily like I won these huge pots, but they're stories where my reads and my ability came into play to help me either win or avoid a huge loss. So the first story is, I look down at pocket tens and I am in the cutoff. Okay, so that means I'm one next to the button. The guy in the, I believe, second seat, it was either under the gun or second seat, is an elderly gentleman, probably in his mid-70s, but I can tell that he's a good player, and he has played only solid values to this point in the tournament, so I know that when he raises from early position, I have to respect his raise. With my pocket tens, a lot of times in position, I'm either going to re-raise, or because I'm in position, if I think that I'm going to get heads up on the raiser, or I'm going to be in a three-way pot, you know, I'm okay with not re-raising there and not getting too involved with a pair of tens. And at this point in the tournament, I wasn't forced to with my stack. So I decided I'm just going to flat call with my tens and see what develops with this guy in the hand. Now, one other person had called, so there was three of us to the flop. The flop came out King-5-3. And one of the things I always tell you about, and I told you about a lot this summer, was that you have to pay attention to what's happening at all times, whether you're in the hand or not, when the cards go out, when the flop goes out. You have to pay attention at all times. If you don't, you're going to miss stuff. And I've told plenty of stories where I've missed stuff because I wasn't paying attention. I'm drinking and talking to buddies, or you know, smoking or whatever, and I'm just not having my normal intuition kick in because I'm not paying enough attention. Well, in this tournament, of course, I'm locked in. I'm in the casino. I'm playing for a lot of money. So I am locked in. And when the flop comes out, I look at the guy who raised. And as the flop comes out, the flop was King-5-3. And he immediately bet into the pot. And when I say immediately, he bet almost before the cards came out. Now, of course, he didn't bet before they came out, but almost. He almost beat the cards into the middle by making a bet on the flop. I knew that when he made that bet, there was no way he could have processed what the cards were in front of him. He couldn't have looked and seen, oh yeah, that's King-5-3. Okay, I'm going to bet this or that. So in my mind, that told me two things. Number one, he was very confident about his hand. And number two, he didn't really care what the flop was before he was going to bet. Now, with a bad player, that could mean a lot of things, and that could go a lot of different ways. But with a good player, I felt like this really narrowed the range of his hands down. So when he made the bet, the other guy got out of the way, and it came around to me. With pocket tens on a King-5-3 flop, that's not exactly a bad flop, okay? Because when you're sitting there with tens, you have the five and the three beat. If the person had ace-king, of course you're beat. But any other pair, you could be in a decent situation because queens or jacks is going to be a little scared of the kings. And anything below tens, of course, you have beat. But that's not a terrible flop for a pair of tens. And I sat there and I sort of tanked on it and I couldn't decide what to do. And I thought normally I would make a call here and peel a card and see how invested in the hand he was. Because it's very possible, you know, he's raising ace queen or he's raising a pair of eights or, you know, maybe he's got jacks and he's going to be scared and he's going to check the turn. And I'm in position. And of course, as we all know, position is king in hold'em. And I've got the position. And if he checks the turn, I can bet and try to steal the pot on the turn. Or maybe, you know, my tens are good. I'm not stealing the pot, but I could win the pot on the turn. So the majority of the time, I'm going to peel off a card with tens there on a king 5-3 flop. But my read on him was really pristine. And I will say that this comes from thousands of hours of poker. And let me break it down for you here real quick. Think about it like this. If you play a live poker tournament and you're not at a casino. Now, I play with my buddies in someone's basement. We don't have deck shufflers, dealers. We don't have somebody keeping the action moving. I would say that in a 60-minute period of time, in 1 hour, we're probably playing between 20 to 30 hands, if we're lucky. That's a really low rate of play. And in a casino, that drops considerably. You might see a hand a minute or so because of the automatic shufflers and the dealers keeping the action moving and people are generally paying attention. But that's not happening in a basement, okay? So if you're one of those players who thinks that you play a lot of poker, step back and think about what that means. These guys in this basement, we used to play 2 to 4 nights a week when I, you know, didn't have kids and we were all younger. But now we're playing maybe once a week, maybe twice a week they're playing. I'm not playing that often, but maybe they are. But think about what that means. In a 52-week year, you may be playing 100 poker tournaments if you're playing twice a week. Or you may be playing 50 to 75. I was playing 50 to 75 poker tournaments a week. I might even play that in 4 or 5 days back in the day when I was playing. And if you think about the difference in the hands being played online versus the hands being played in a casino versus the hands being played at a home game, it is a massive difference. You're only going to see a premium hand about every 3 rotations around the table. You're only going to see pocket aces once out of every 220 hands. So if you're playing a typical home game where you're playing a hand every 2 or 3 minutes and you play a 5-hour tournament, you can do the math there. You're not seeing that many hands, okay? So for me, in the long run, playing online, I've probably played 25 or 30,000 poker tournaments. And people who think when they play live that they play, quote unquote, a lot of poker, they don't. You can't measure up to the experience that you get online, to the amount of experience that you can pack into an online session or to a session in a casino. So back to the point, and that is that I'm feeling really good in position with my tens, and I'm feeling like that's not a terrible flop. But what I know of this player and the way that he went about this whole situation has me concerned. The preflop raise in early position, the fact that I know him to play solid values, and the fact that he tried to bet before he could process what cards were on the flop all told me that I might be in a really bad spot. And in fact, you know what popped into my head? This guy has aces. He did not care what that flop was. If he had jacks, he'd want to see if the overcards flopped. If he had queens, he'd want to see what flopped. Now, sometimes they're going to bet there anyway with jacks or queens because they know that you have to hit a king. But there was a king on the flop, and it was a scary flop for one of those hands. So I thought to myself, this guy does not care about that flop. He's a good player. He raised another gun. I think this guy has aces. And so I just folded, and I folded my tens face up. And I do that a lot, A, to show the other people at the table that I'm not an idiot and that they should respect my play. But also a lot of times I do that because I want the other player to feel comfortable with me, to feel happy with me, and to maybe show me their cards. And that's exactly what happened. The old man flipped up a pair of aces. I had it nailed perfectly. Pristine read, perfect understanding of the situation. And that comes from long, long hours of understanding poker and understanding the situation. I nailed that read, and I saved myself a significant bet on the flop and possibly the turn because I was able to fold on the flop after one bet. I thought that was a great open fold. And that only comes through the grind and through the process. But let me tell you a second story because I like this story too. I'm in a tournament recently where, this is the same tournament, by the way, good players. I am in the small blind. There's one limper. We're only six-handed, okay? We're six-handed. So hands take on a stronger value at this point. And I'm in the small blind, and there's a limper, and then there's a guy on the button, and he limps. And I know the guy on the button from long time ago when I used to play at a different casino, and I've seen him pop up at random times in different tournaments. He's a good player. And in fact, probably one of the best players in the tournament. He limps on the button, and I'm in the small blind. I'm like, yeah, sure, I'm limping. I've got an ace and a seven. Not a bad hand, but I'm out of position. Don't really want to pay any money to play it, but I want to, of course, limp in if I can because there's going to be four people in the pot. I limp in with my ace seven. The big blind checks. Perfect. We're going to go to the flop. The flop is ace 10 nine. Now, that sounds like a fun flop, right? I flop top pair. There's only three other people in the pot, and we're six-handed. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't have enough chips to lead out into three people here. My hand's not strong enough. And I went through the process quickly as I could because I'm first to act. And I decided check is the right play. So I check, big blind checks, other limper checks, and the strong player on the button fires out a bet. Again, this comes down to paying attention to what's happening when it's happening. What he did was he grabbed some chips and fired them into the pot with two hands. Sometimes that read is that that person is firing those chips out there because they want you to believe they're confident and they're throwing them in there like, I got a good hand. You need to fold. But I know this guy and I know him well enough to know he's not an idiot who likes to make bluffs into three people. And I'm thinking to myself, I don't know that my ace seven is good here. I know that's crazy. And you're thinking, oh boy, here's Drew the nit talking again. But I know this guy enough to know, boy, oh boy, is my seven any good? Because what do I have beat? The flop is ace 10 nine. I only have ace six beat. If he's got ace eight, ace nine, ace 10, or anything better, I'm beat. And I'm thinking to myself, boy, looking at that 10 nine, that's always a hand people like to limp, and especially in position. And I just came to the conclusion that he had demonstrated a pretty specific tell. And that is that when you are confident in your hand, now we were at the stage in the tournament, keep in mind, we were at the stage in the tournament where your chips are low enough that if you make a bet like that on the flop and somebody raises you, you either know you're going to fold or you're going to shove. There really isn't any much, you know, much more playing of the pot on the turn or the river. So I thought to myself, he could certainly fold if I put in a raise, if he doesn't have anything. If this is a position bet, it's a position raise, I call. So I thought about that, and I thought, well, that's possible. But the more likely scenario is that I'm beat here because the tell was pretty clear. He grabbed some chips and he threw them in the pot. Well, what's the tell? The tell is when a player that you're playing against grabs chips and throws them into the pot and they don't count the chips, they don't look at whether or not they were betting the correct amount into the pot or whether they were betting the correct amount relative to their stack size. If they just grab chips and they throw them in, they feel really strong. Well, why? Because they think they're getting those chips back. Or they think if you raise them, they're shoving the rest of their chips in. They don't care. So they don't care about those chips they put in the pot, not because they're bluffing, because they don't care about the chips. They don't care about the amount because they're going with the hand. And I think this is an extremely reliable tell. And it's one that you should look for in your games. My tell on him was pretty simple. And my read on him as a good player, I folded the A7. I open folded it. I didn't even opt for a call. And I certainly wasn't going to raise. I fold. The other two guys fold. And I look at the guy and he's like, what'd you have, ace eight? Now, I had a pretty good laugh about that because, like I said, he's a good player. I had ace seven in my hand. And all it took me was a little bit of a beat. Like, I didn't even really tank. I didn't tank at all. I maybe paused for like 3 seconds and folded my hand. And he knew me too. I mean, look, he knows I'm a nit. He knows I'm a tight player. He knows I'm a good player. And he knew from that little 3 seconds of hesitation that I had a hand that I was trying to decide whether or not to go with. And he knew at that point it wasn't ace jack. It certainly wasn't aces up with ace 10 or ace 9 to make two pair. It wasn't ace jack or ace queen, or else I probably would have raised, or I'd be raising on the flop. So he knew that it was a weaker ace, but also not ace deuce, because I would have snap folded ace deuce or ace three. So he had narrowed me down to that range, and he'd done it quite quickly and perfectly, and said, "Would you have ace eight?" And I kind of laughed, like, "That was damn close, man. That's a good read." I said, "I had ace seven." I said, "Would you have?" He's like, "Yeah, bottom two." I'm like, "Yeah, of course." Again, my read here was pristine. Everything about it. The tell, the knowledge of the player, the situation, I nailed it, and it saved my tournament. And in that situation against a bad player, I'm shoving that A7. But against that player, and with that read, I folded it. The process matters, and it's not always going to work out. And here's the end of the story. What did that do? That saved my tournament for me to then turn around six-handed and pick up jacks, and I shoved my jacks right into aces, and I was out. I bet y'all thought that was going to have a happy ending, didn't you? You thought, oh, cool, he saved his tournament, and he went on to win some money. Hell no. I picked up Jack six-handed, the fourth best hand in poker, and shoved into aces. But hey, the point is, I saved my tournament there with the A7. The process matters. The fact that I figured that all out, it all mattered in the end, and it gave me a chance to go with those jacks in a six-handed situation, which is a strong, strong situation. I just got unlucky. I was against aces. If you're getting unlucky and you're running into aces every week, don't give up, because that just means you're playing well enough to be there. If you're never there and you're just shoving ace deuce and losing the king 10, then worry about your process. But if you're putting yourself in a position to win every week in fantasy football, the wins will come. All right, so what are those things we can do? There's three things I want you to be doing right now heading into week six. Number one, stop trading your depth, okay? I don't know many people who have come to me with a, hey, should I trade this guy for this guy offer that have enough depth to be making these deals. I'm not saying the deals themselves are bad, but my point is this is the first week with buys. You have gotten along to this point without any buys. You have to understand, I think we get to a point in the season where we've reached a saturation point with injuries, and that'll happen later in the season too. Like, you'll head into week 14, you'll be like, all right, week 15, it's the playoffs. Nothing bad can happen now. There's only a couple of weeks of the season left. Yeah, tell that to my team that should have won a title 2 years ago when I had Chris Godwin and Derrick Henry, and they both got hurt in week 15, and I went to the Super Bowl with some trash and lost. Point is, injuries will continue to happen every single week. Do not be trading your depth right now. I just can't stress this enough. Don't be trading your depth in week 5. If you can make a deal and you still have one or two players on your bench that you can stick in for buys or injuries, then go for it. But I'm going to sit here and tell you one thing. You can never have enough depth. I play in a 14-team league with my office, with the public defender's office. And I drafted a really deep team in that league. In fact, I have no business having such a good team for a 14-teamer. Of course, I'm 2-3. That's how it goes. The point is, I have lost it guy after guy after guy. I've lost McCaffrey and Clyde Edwards-Helaire and James White and just whatever, just name it. I've had injuries in that league. And you think that you have a lot of depth now, your depth will be tested by injuries and buys coming up really quickly. Don't forget week 7. I've been joking around about it on Twitter, but it's true. It's buy-mageddon. Okay. There are so many fantasy relevant players on buy in week 7. Right now, you should be going to your roster and looking to see whether or not you have options to play in week 7. In one of my leagues, I didn't even have enough players to play week 7. I went out this week and picked up Marquez Callaway and Rondale Moore. They're going to be in my starting lineup in a 10-teamer because my wide receivers are Deontay Johnson, Adam Thielen, CeeDee Lamb, Stephon Diggs, and Emmanuel Sanders. They all have week 7 buys. be looking at week seven right now. And for the love of God, do not be trading your depth away. It's okay if you can afford to make a deal that makes your team stronger, or you have to make a deal because you got a hole in your starting lineup. I get all that. But don't be sitting here in week five being like, I'm rolling, bro. I'm killing everybody. I'm going to go trade for Dalvin Cook because his value is low and I can trade away these two bench guys. Don't do it. Do not do it. I'm here to tell you it's going to hurt. And when the buys come around, there is something that people in fantasy football tend to forget. If you have that deep team, it feels like those points are wasting away on your bench. But that's not true, because when buys come around, the teams that don't have the depth, they're suffering from injuries too, you know, probably, but they're suffering from injuries too, and they're going to suffer in those bye weeks, whereas you will not. You will run out good players every week because of the fact that you have that depth. Your average points per game is going to stay higher than theirs will. So your depth is going to carry you through these bye weeks and hopefully get you more points for that tiebreaker at the end of the year, and more wins to get into the playoffs. So don't be trading your depth. Don't be looking at the situation right now like, hey, I'm good. Nothing can possibly go wrong, because it can and it will. Okay, next point, buy low, sell high. Now, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that you should never buy low and never sell high. Of course, that is a part of fantasy football. But I really believe that this is an overblown part of the game. People are always telling you, go out and sell Cordero Patterson high. Okay, well, you'd have to be high for somebody to accept a deal for his current value. And this is a really important part of human psychology that I think people don't think about enough. And it's something that I talked about over the summer. And it's real simple. If you think it, others probably do too. Okay, repeat that in your head. If you think it, others probably do too. A perfect example is Mark Andrews going off last night. Before last night, Mark Andrews had had a very, very pedestrian start to the year. No games over 11 points, I believe. He just was having a rough year. Now, the Mark Andrews managers, they're going to want to be selling Mark Andrews if they can. Here's the thing. How do you feel about Mark Andrews today? Look at your own feelings about him. You feel better about him, don't you? He went and put up 1.5 billion points. I think it was 1.5 billion. Might have been like 1.25 billion. The point is, if you think it, others do too. Your perception of Mark Andrews today is way better than it was, right? And the same thing for Dalvin Cook. How do you feel about Dalvin Cook right now? You feel crappy about him, right? Others feel crappy about him too. So I understand that creates a buy low moment. But you need to ask yourself whether or not that buy low moment is really a buy low, or whether it's just what that player is now, and whether a sell high is really a sell high. Because a prime example is Cordero Patterson. Do you think that people are buying that high right now? And also, it makes it harder for you to want to sell high, because you feel so good about him. If you think it, others do too. Don't forget that. I believe that buy low, sell high is largely a myth. And also, on top of that, it is risky. Don't sit here and tell yourself it's not risky. I still remember trading for LaDainian Tomlinson when he had a groin injury a long time ago. He won me a title. But you know what? The key phrase is a long time ago. That worked out for me. But I bet you that was 10, 12 years ago. I don't even know when the heck it was. It might have been longer. That might have been 15 years ago that I traded for LaDainian Tomlinson when he was hurt and won a title. It doesn't happen very often. Trading for injured players is a bad idea, number one. And number two, trying to buy low, if you're dealing with a manager who doesn't realize the value of that player, maybe you're playing in more of a low-level league. That's fine. I understand that. But most astute fantasy players are not going to go sell you a player just because they've had a couple bad weeks. If you come to me and ask me for Adam Thielen right now, I'm not giving him to you because he had 6 points this week. I still believe he's a red zone threat. I still believe he's a guy who's going to finish in the top 24. I don't really care about your argument at this point. So I believe that's a myth. I think you should largely ignore buy low, sell high. And sure, in situations you can do it. I'm not saying don't ever do it. I'm just saying remember the overarching point, the human psychology. If you think it, others do too. All right, the final thing I want to talk to you about is if you're struggling right now, what are you doing about trying to remake your roster? Now, there are situations where your roster is fine and you're just struggling because you've had injuries or because guys are underperforming. I got a team like that right now, the team I just talked about, Thielen, Lamb, Diggs. I got McCaffrey and Mixon on that team. Like, that's a really stacked team. It's a good team. I'm not going to panic sell anybody, but I'm 2-3 and I'm facing the best team in the league this week. And then I go into week 7 where my entire wide receiver core is off. I could be 2-5 heading into week 8. The point is this, if you believe that your team is in trouble, go take your best player on your roster. I know it sucks. I know this is hard. Trading is hard and it's risky. Okay. And that's what I'm talking about in my previous 2 points, trading your depth, buying low, selling high. That stuff is risky. Trading itself is risky. Don't ever forget that. Things change drastically from what we see now to what we see in the future. If you're selling on Stephon Diggs this week, he gets a fantastic set of matchups in the next couple weeks, starting with Tennessee on Monday night. You think Stephon Diggs isn't going to go off on the Tennessee Titans secondary? Now, maybe he's not going to have 40, but he's going to have a nice game. Okay, so it's risky. And what I'm telling you is, at this point, if you're 1-4 or 0-5, or whatever the case may be, you're not scoring points, you need to take that risk. And that risk is now. You're a third of the way to the playoffs. You cannot wait. So the point is, isolate the best possible player on your roster and go flip him. I know that sucks. I know you drafted Dalvin Cook and you were excited about it. I know you drafted Christian McCaffrey and you're excited about it. So what? Go deal that player and get 3 starters back, or get 2 starters back to high level, or 3 solid starters. Be trying to be proactive about your roster. If you're struggling, and it's not just variance, there's a reason you're struggling, because some of the guys on your team are underperforming. You can't afford to wait. Go flip those guys right now. I'm always the advocate of being the guy later in the season who's trying to trade for 1 stud by offering up 2 or 3 guys on my team that I can't get in my lineup every week. But I'm advocating the opposite here. If you're struggling and you're 1-4 or 0-5, something like that, you have to be flipping a player like that right now. Let somebody else think they're swooping in to quote unquote buy low. Who cares? It doesn't matter whether you help that team. It matters whether you help your team. And if you can get 2 starters for a perceived stud, or you can get 3 for a guy like McCaffrey or Cook or somebody like that, you do it. Do the calculation. Figure out how much it's going to improve your weekly output and do it. And do it right now. Okay, well, that's enough theory for right now. Drew's Clues is about talking about specific situations. So just because we're doing a podcast doesn't mean I'm going to ramble about all that theory the whole time. I want to talk about some specific players and situations, and let's do it in kind of a lightning round fashion. I'm not going to throw as many stats at you as I do in the Twitter format of Drew's Clues, because I think it's a little bit harder to follow along. But I solicited some topics from my followers. I'm going to go through and hit, I think, every one of those, throw a couple of my own on the end. But we've already hit almost an hour of the show, and I think that we can do this relatively quickly, and I can help you with some of the decisions you're making. Now, keep in mind, this is not a waiver wire show. There's plenty of waiver wire information out there. Go find a waiver wire article. I don't care. I think you've got plenty of resources for that. I'm in a different spot here where I want to try to talk to you about more ethereal ideas, more nebulous concepts going forward. Yes, certainly I want to talk about snaps and routes run and target share and all that stuff. But my goal here is not to be a waiver wire show. My goal here is to try to project this thing out for the rest of the season. And keep in mind, when I'm giving this advice, I'm talking about quote-unquote normal size leagues. That's 10 to 12 team leagues. I'm not talking about 14 teamers or bigger or super flex or tight end premium or big contests or DFS or dynasty. Keep in mind, my specialty is redraft, and I'm trying to tell you how to win your redraft leagues, and I'm trying to talk to you about normal 10 to 12 team leagues. Also keep in mind, if nothing has really changed with a player, I'm not going to generally hit them in Drew's Clues, because I think that we've spelled out the majority of the situations in the NFL right now, and I think they're pretty much what they are. What's going on with Derrick Henry? Well, we know what Derrick Henry's doing, okay? What's going on with Miles Sanders? At this point, I've talked about Miles Sanders till I'm blue in the face. He is what he is. They're not using him like they should use him. They're not giving him enough routes, enough targets, enough carries. Miles Sanders is what he is at this point. Believe what they're telling you. Believe what the coaching staff is showing you. All right? I don't believe in coaching speak. Coach speak sucks. But evidence, the evidence that the coaching staff is giving you are their snaps, their routes, their targets, how much time they're on the field. All that stuff is what it is right now. Miles Sanders is what he is. I'm not going to talk about Miles Sanders, okay? But let's talk about some guys that we are struggling to figure out at this point in the season. I don't think there's a bigger example of that than the 49ers offense. So let's start right there. What are we doing with the 49ers offense? This one's hard. And I'm going to say some things that are going to irritate some people. But let's do it anyway. The backfield is a complete mess. And if you haven't figured that out by now, I'm not doing my job. Because I've been talking about it in Drew's Clues since week one. Elijah Mitchell is the guy to have right now. Jeff Wilson is the guy to have later. Trey Sermon is not the guy to have at all. All right. I said after week two that you should be dropping Trey Sermon. People are just finally coming around to the idea now. I'm not always right. And I'm going to tell you this. I drop guys before most people do. I am generally ahead of the curve. I dropped Tyson Williams a couple weeks ago. I dropped Latavius Murray 3 weeks ago. These guys, we're going to talk about the Ravens' backs later. The point is, I told you to drop Trey Sermon after week two. If you still don't want to drop him now, I got no hope for you. In a 10 or 12 teamer, he should not be on a roster. He played. Here's the weird part. We know that there's no confidence from the coaching staff about Trey Sermon. As soon as Elijah Mitchell could play, coming off an injury, he handled almost all of the backfield touches. And in fact, Sermon, I believe, only touched the ball one or two times. I think it might have been one. I don't even care. I didn't bother to look it up because I don't care. The point is, in that backfield, there were 29% of the snaps that neither Mitchell nor Sermon was even on the field. It was either empty set or juice check. So 30%, almost a third of the time, they don't even want Mitchell or Sermon on the field. What the hell are you holding Trey Sermon for anymore? Drop his ass. Now, if you are in a bigger league, yeah, hold on to him. If you can afford, if you got a big bench and you can afford to hold Sermon, do it, because Mitchell hasn't exactly proven to be an Iron Man. Mitchell's going to get some carries. Excuse me. Sermon's going to get the carries if Mitchell goes down before Jeff Wilson comes back. So it's purely a handcuff. But even that, I don't even care about the handcuff. Look at what Sermon did when Mitchell was out. It was not impressive. Take away the touchdown where he fell into the end zone. His numbers are pathetic. Okay, so we're dropping Sermon. We're stashing Wilson. We're holding Mitchell. I don't really want to start him. He's a real meh start. Here's the problem. He's not getting many targets. They don't feel comfortable throwing him the ball. So while he's running routes and nobody else is, they'd rather throw the ball to Juice Check or somebody else. And frankly, with Trey Lance in there, he's tucking the ball and running before he's going to dump it off. Garoppolo is going to be back. It doesn't matter. I'm just rambling about the situation, and my take's pretty clear. Get rid of Sermon. Hold Mitchell if you want. Wilson's a stash. I don't care about anybody in that backfield, though. What about the wide receiver core? Well, here's the weird part. Brandon Ayuk started in the doghouse. Shanahan claims it was injury, whatever. The point is, right now, Ayuk is playing the second most snaps on the team. He's got the second most routes run every week. But here's the weird thing. He has an almost even target share with Mohamed Sanu after the last couple weeks. So the last 2 weeks, Mohamed Sanu is getting as many looks as Ayuk is. Trey Lance is not elevating these wide receivers whatsoever. He looks like a rookie. Shanahan keeps saying Garoppolo is the guy when he comes back. They've got a bye this week. Garoppolo could be playing as early as week 7. Now, that may help Ayuk. It may. The point is, it's a weird situation there, and I'm not sure that the volume's high enough that you care about Ayuk as long as Debo's healthy. Now, you can't drop Ayuk. You can't, because Debo has a long history of getting hurt. So you're holding Ayuk, but right now, I think what we're seeing is what he's going to be the rest of the year, absent changes. Of course, Sanu could get hurt, or Debo could get hurt, or whatever. But I believe even when Garoppolo comes back, he just is what he is right now. All right. I had a question about TJ Hockenson. What the heck is going on with TJ Hockenson? Well, in a word, nothing. Nothing's going on with Hockenson. I don't think anything has significantly changed. His snap share, his routes run, they're all really solid. He hasn't had the targets in 2 of the last 3 weeks that we expect him to have. I don't really think anything is going on here, but I do think that teams, they really don't have to respect anyone else on that offense. It's going to be annoying. There's no wide receivers that make anyone care. So all they have to worry about is DeAndre Swift, and that's about it. So I believe the TJ Hockenson thing is going to be frustrating. He's going to have his up and down weeks, but his snap share, his routes run, they're rock solid. They have not changed recently. It's just that he hasn't had the targets of the production. That's going to be there. His metrics are fine. TJ Hockenson's fine. It's just that he's going to be a little frustrating to own. He's not going to be a 15 to 18 point a week guy. And unfortunately, that's the byproduct of having a bunch of receivers injured and having no other weapons on the offense. I don't think you can trade Hockenson because his value is so low. And I don't think you're going to really upgrade anywhere at tight end anyway. So unless you're getting some deal on a player that you need at another position, Hockenson, unfortunately, he's just a hold. What's going on with the Ravens backfield? Well, I got the question from my buddy Chad Bray, who's a big supporter of mine. And I made a joke. No, I'm sorry. Excuse me. It was Mr. Hay, Flair Hay. And we talk a lot on Twitter. And he said, "What are we doing with the Ravens backfield?" And I said, "Nothing." I was being flip, but I'm serious. Like, are we holding anybody in the Ravens backfield? No. In a regular 10 or 12 teamer, I can understand if Latavius Murray's your RB4 or RB5 and you're holding him because there's nobody else better on the wire. But you've heard me talk about on Twitter before what I like to call free agent bombs or waiver wire bombs. I like to drop bombs onto the wire because, let's be honest, unless I'm really, really in a bad spot, I never want to start Latavius Murray. He's not catching any passes. He needs to fall in the end zone to have any relevance. So who are we holding on the Ravens back in the Ravens backfield? Nobody. I'm not holding anybody. I dropped Tyson Williams several weeks ago. I dropped Latavius Murray several weeks ago. They obviously like something that these veterans are doing, that Murray's doing, that Freeman's doing. They like what those guys bring to the table. I noticed that Freeman played a lot when the Ravens were in catch-up mode, and Murray plays a lot on early downs and gets the goal line work. Tyson Williams is not relevant. I don't care if he was active and Le'Veon Bell was inactive. I don't want any of them. Right now, I'm tapping out completely on the Ravens backfield. If you're in deeper leagues, you have to hold these guys. I get that. But in 10 or 12 teamers, why are we holding those guys? Drop a waiver wire bomb. Get them off your roster. Get somebody else on there who's got some upside. Get a defense on there that you need in a couple weeks or a tight end for a bye week. Whatever. Play the game. Don't worry about your player evaluation. Well, Latavius Murray, no. We're done with the Ravens backfield. I had another question about what are we doing with wide receiver ones on bad teams? Guys like Corey Davis, Brandon Cooks, Marvin Jones. Well, I'll say this. They're going to be really inconsistent. And I'll make the analogy to the TJ Hockenson thing. When you are one of the only options on the field, it's going to be frustrating to be a manager of those players. But one of the things I like to talk about at this point in the season is we are now 5 weeks into the season. You should have your starting lineups ready to go every week. You shouldn't be playing a lot of lineup bingo where you're trying to run guys in and out of your lineups based on matchups. That is a surefire way to ensure that you get poor production from that spot in your lineup as you're shuttling guys in and out. 5 weeks into the season, you should know who your starters are, and you should be starting them every single week. And unless you have an all-star cast of players on your team, you should be starting Corey Davis, Marvin Jones, Brandon Cooks. You have to start those guys. And here's the things. They're going to suffer at times from how bad the offense is or from poor quarterback play. But all three of these players have one thing in common. They lead their team in snap share, target share, and routes run percentage. They're getting more snaps, more targets, and more routes than any other player on their team. You have to hold them, and you have to start them, unless you got a real all-star cast that you can run out there ahead of these guys. I know it's frustrating. They're going to be inconsistent, but you can't bench them. I had a question about Chase Edmonds. Is he a game script dependent starter? That's an interesting question. I don't think that he is. This week, he had a bad week, but he was battling a shoulder injury. He actually saw a bit of a hit on his snaps and routes run and his carries. He took a hit this week. He only scored 4.4 PPR points. It was a tough week. But I went back and looked. Before he came into week five, through 4 weeks of the season, Chase Edmonds was PPR RB 11. This guy was an RB 1 after a month of the season, and he has zero touchdowns. Now, I talked about Chase Edmonds a lot in the offseason, and I ended up with him on several teams because I just didn't understand the calculation that people were making, that they didn't really want a part of Chase Edmonds. Last year, he finished as an RB2, as a low-end RB2, and he did so with another guy in the backfield taking all the carries and all the goal line carries and taking some of the receptions and whatnot. They brought a guy in, James Conner, who is limited in his skill set and in his ability to stay healthy, and talked about how they're going to give Chase Edmonds more opportunities. So I thought, well, if you even add 25 or 50 or 75 opportunities to Edmonds' workload, why would his low RB2 finish not turn into a mid to high RB2 finish? And that's where I felt all off season. And I believe that's largely come true. Like I said, before week five, he was RB 11. He was a low end RB 1 on the season. I don't believe he's a game script dependent guy. I really don't. They do things that they like with him, design screens. They throw him the ball. He'll score some touchdowns. It'll happen. Now, maybe he's not going to score 8, but he's going to score 4 or 5 touchdowns. This guy's going to be an RB2. He struggled this week with the injury. His snaps, routes, run, carries, it all took a bit of a hit this week, but I think that was injury related. I didn't hear that he got hurt anymore coming out of the game. Stick with Chase Edmonds. What's going on in Detroit? The wide receivers and the running backs. Well, let me hit the sexy one first, the running backs. I have a lot of Jamal Williams. I've made no bones about it. I love Jamal Williams. But I think we're in a tough spot here if you're Jamal Williams managers. His routes run fell off a cliff after week 3. He was running in the mid-30s, 33 to 38 to 40% routes run in the first 3 weeks. In the last 2 weeks, he's been at 11% and 15%. That is a bad sign for Jamal Williams managers, me included. DeAndre Swift's health has allowed him to take over more routes, more carries, more time in the field. This is a bad situation for Jamal Williams at this point. He is not getting the involvement in the passing work or the goal line work that I thought made him the high leverage play. Instead, Swift's getting those carries and those touches. And even though Williams is getting plenty of carries, they still like him to grind in between the tackles. It has not turned in the fantasy production. Now, I'm not saying that he should be dropped. He should absolutely be a hold, and he's a guy that you can run out there in bye weeks for injuries, and certainly in deeper leagues, he's a hold. But right now, DeAndre Swift is taking this backfield over. All right. And what's going on in the wide receiver core? Now, I feel like I've been spending all this time talking about the Lions, but it's important because they're dropping like flies in the wide receiver core in Detroit. There's one guy left standing at this point, and that's Amon-Ra St. Brown. I know he's a rookie, but last week he played the most snaps, had the most routes run. And you have to understand that with Tyrell Williams, look, that's a bad situation. He had a concussion week one. We have not heard from him. We're going into week six. We still haven't heard an update from Tyrell Williams. That's not good. I don't know if this is going to end up being a long-term, like where he's done for the year. They haven't said that, but we have to start operating under the assumption that now Quintez Cephas is hurt. We are getting deep into the depth chart, and St. Brown is now looking like a guy who could become relevant the second half of the year. Like I said, this past week, most snaps, most routes run, and you can't ignore Khalif Raymond either. So both of these guys are the starters right now. In deeper leagues, you have to be looking at both of them. But I believe that the wide receiver core is so bad that in 10 or 12 team leagues, I'm not super interested in either guy. But you have to understand that they're running out of options. So they're throwing the ball to Swift, and they're handing the ball off to Jamal Williams, but the rest of the team is really shaky. Hockenson, the pass catchers, St. Brown, Raymond, they're all going to have their moments, but it's real shaky. Real, real shaky. Some of these situations that we think are going to be shootouts have not turned into shootouts lately. I mean, they only scored 17 points against the Ravens a couple weeks ago. What was it this past week that they... It was the same thing. They scored 17 against the Vikings, who don't have a very good defense. So these Lions games are not turning into shootouts like we thought they were. They're struggling with injury. Boy, oh boy, it's a bad situation in Detroit. All right, a couple more quick ones before I get you out of here. I've had a blast doing this, but I think that we've gone long enough for Drew's Clues, but I still have some things I want to talk about real briefly. In Arizona, pay attention to Rondale Moore. I know that that everybody was excited about him before the season, and then he started out with a couple good weeks, but then he fell off the map and people dropped him. If he's been dropped in your league, consider this. He had more routes run this week than Christian Kirk. That's the first time that's happened this year. I don't know if that's a trend or not, but it certainly is something to monitor. If he moves up to third in routes run on that team, who knows whether he could take over the AJ Green routes run. Probably not, because it's a different position, but this is worth monitoring. If he passes Christian Kirk on the depth chart and this is a trend, then you need to have Rondale Moore on your team. A couple tight end notes. In Miami, Mike Gesicki has turned in a couple decent weeks in a row, but why is that? I really believe that that's a product of Jacoby Brissett. Tua Tagovailoa is set to come off the IR this week. Could very well play. I don't think Tua likes Gesicki as much as Brissett did. That was something that we saw as a product of the backup quarterback playing. So I'm a little bit concerned. However, in week five, Gesicki's snap share and routes run were at a season high. So the trend has been good for Gesicki. I want to see what happens with Tua before I declare him a guy that you want to hold the rest of the season. Because it really makes me nervous to have Tua back under center after this production came with Brissett. The other tight end I want to talk about is Hunter Henry. In New England, we thought that we would see the situation shake out after the first month of the season, and we have seen that. Jonnu Smith is now a guy who's staying in the block a lot more, and Hunter Henry is clearly the guy to have for fantasy production. Here's the thing. I don't want you to get super excited about Hunter Henry's game this past week. His snap share, his routes run, it didn't really change that much this week. He just caught a touchdown, and he caught a few more of his targets. So he had a bit of a soft matchup, and he produced with a touchdown. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't hold on to Henry. I just mean that I wouldn't get super excited about the touchdown this week. I would just say that between the two, Henry's clearly the guy that you want to have. However, I'm not ready to call this a trend yet, until I see more. The last guy I want to talk about is Chase Claypool. And I don't know why, but I'm on fantasy Twitter. I'm in the Twitter bubble. A lot of you are. Some of you aren't, but a lot of you are. And I have not seen anybody talking about Chase Claypool this week. And I don't get it. Now, I know it's only Tuesday, but Juju Smith-Schuster is out for the year with a shoulder injury. And Chase Claypool is the guy that we said all off season. If he can have an expanded role, he'll be this. If he can get more targets, he'll be this. If he can blah, 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 He'll be this. Well, guess what, folks? That's now. Schuster is done for the year, probably never going to be a Pittsburgh Steeler again. In Dynasty, I understand we don't know what's going on with the quarterback situation, but Chase Claypool is a screaming buy anywhere. I don't know why people aren't talking about this more. We're getting the situation that we wanted to see with Claypool, and he delivered a couple weeks ago when Schuster was out. I believe that Claypool had like 9 for 92 maybe. I didn't look it up. Point is, he had a ton of targets. He wasn't just a deep guy. They were using him as an actual receiver to catch the ball short. You know, the 9 for 92 was encouraging, but this past week he caught a touchdown. Look, why are we not excited about Chase Claypool at this point? Go trade for him. Go pick him up. Go do whatever. I had somebody say that they were on the, that Claypool was on the wire. I think that's wild to me, but yes, you should be throwing your fab at him, doing whatever it takes to get Chase Claypool right now. The time that we wanted, the production that we wanted is right there for the taking. I know Ben Roethlisberger sucks. I get that. But Claypool and Deontay Johnson, with no Schuster in the way, they're going to eat. All right, well, I think that I could go on. Like I said, I could just go down every single roster in the NFL and talk about every player, and that would be fun, but also probably pretty boring for some of you. I think this show has gone long enough. I've really had a blast getting in front of the mic again. I can't believe it's been 6 weeks. It feels like I just finished my last show, but then it also feels like a billion years ago because so much has changed and so much has happened. I hope this episode helps you playing the game. Don't forget, yes, it's super fun to be the right, you know, to be in on a player before everyone else, to be right about a player, to be right about fading a guy or whatever the case may be. All the player evaluation stuff is fun, and that's why we play. But also, don't forget that we play to win. And let me do my best Herm Edwards here. You play to win the game. Don't worry so much about being right or wrong on a player. People laugh at me all the time. I'll go out and I'll pick up a player. I'll have him for 2 days or I'll have him for 1 week and I drop immediately. Yeah, okay. So maybe that makes me impetuous. I don't know. The point is, I don't care. I'm playing the game. I'm taking a shotgun approach to that waiver wire sometimes because we don't know who's going to develop. We don't know who's going to be that lightning in a bottle. Did you think Marquise Brown was going to be that lightning in a bottle? No, neither did I. Most people didn't. So the point is, take that shotgun approach. Put away your pride. Grind, grind, grind. Find the people you like that tell you good information. Follow them. Follow me. Do whatever it takes to fill your head with that information. But in the end, understand that we are playing a game. And part of playing the game is understanding the game theory, the way you go about playing the game. And it's not always about whether you're right or wrong about the players. It's about playing the game to win. So I hope you've enjoyed this week's episode of the Auction Brief. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm going to be back in a couple of weeks, and I'm going to have somebody on to talk about some injury stuff. We'll get you set up for the stretch run. We'll talk about plays that you should be making for guys for the playoffs, what moves you should be making now that the bulk of the buys are gone, and how you should be setting yourself up for a championship run. Thank you so much for joining me for this special in-season edition of the Auction Brief. I am your host, Drew Davenport. It's been a pleasure being here. It's been a pleasure talking to you. It's been so fun to be back. I'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode. Thank you so much for joining me. The Auction Brief is adjourned, and I'm out.
The Auction Brief is adjourned. That'll do it for this week's episode. See you next time on The Auction Brief.